Welcome to Skip LaCour's Bodybuilding and Fitness Podcast. Six-time national champion bodybuilder, one-on-one peak performance coaching specialist, Mass Machine Nutrition Supplement Company owner, and speaker Skip LaCour offers his expert advice on training, nutrition, and motivation that will help you take your efforts to the next level. He also interviews the most interesting and passionate people in the bodybuilding and fitness world so you can learn from their knowledge and success too.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this bodybuilding and fitness podcast. I am Skip LaCour, and in this special series of bodybuilding and fitness podcast, I am bringing you the most interesting and passionate people in the bodybuilding and fitness world. During this podcast, I am bringing to you a legend in the bodybuilding world. I mean, his record, it speaks for itself. He is a Hall of Fame bodybuilder, the greatest bodybuilders of all time. He's among them. And more than that, and what's so interesting to me, he's just had a track record of success, it seems like, his entire life. And before his bodybuilding career, obviously during his bodybuilding career, and the beat goes on. Right now he's passing along to his kids, which is quite interesting. I really want to get into his mindset. I want you to learn this success mindset. I'll try to bring it out for him. Maybe he's got some lessons for you, and maybe through conversation. He has been in the top five in the Mr. Olympia contest. And for those of you who don't know, that's the Super Bowl of bodybuilding competition. 12 consecutive years in the top five. Just think about that level of dedication and consistency for so many years. Definitely deserving of that Hall of Fame status. Welcome to this bodybuilding and fitness podcast, Sean Ray. Sean, how are you, sir?
Hey, Skip. It's a pleasure to be here and finally catch up with you, my man.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, we've gone way back. I mean, I've been studying your career long before we actually met, and we did meet a long time ago. We started working together, so I have a lot of respect and admiration for you, and I'm really appreciative of you being in this podcast. I get to go right to the top of the bodybuilding and fitness world by having you on this podcast. So thank you so much. And all the people who follow me, they know that I get into more than the sets and reps. You can kind of get that anywhere. It's that mindset, though. When you have that mindset, you can almost take any training strategy and any contest prep strategy and any eating strategy and really make the most out of it and really, you know, create that physique that you want, or you can certainly be well on your way to make the adjustments there. It's that mindset that's lacking most of the time. Isn't that what you see throughout your long career in bodybuilding and fitness?
Well, I mean, it's what I lived. I mean, I like yourself, I've given many speeches and told my story since I started out. I started out as a teenage California bodybuilding champion, and shortly thereafter, I was a teenage Mr. America champion. You know, I won the Nationals, the same one that Lee Haney won. And, you know, 3 years out of high school, I was winning the national championships, getting my pro card and signing a contract with Joe Weider. And he gave me a $1,000 contract, Skip. Uh-huh. I moved out of my mom's house. I stayed in school because the $1,000 covered my $700 rent and my $289 car payment. And I had to figure out how to make it work. You know, I needed insurance. I still needed to eat. You know, I needed food. I needed gas. And on pretty much a leap of faith, I went ahead and took that $1,000 and tried to find a way to monetize my career very early on. And the one thing that resonated throughout my career whenever I was talking to younger guys and paying it back after I got out of bodybuilding is that, like basketball, there are very few Michael Jordans and Magic Johnsons and Larry Birds and Kobe Bryants. But what separates those guys that are Hall of Fame and that are the creme de la creme in basketball is, yeah, anyone can pick up a basketball and dribble it and shoot hoops and you know, block a couple of shots and play some man-to-man defense. But the mindset of the ones that went all the way to the top is that, you know, they went to bed with that basketball. They woke up with that basketball. They knew what all the other people were doing while they were still paying attention to what they were doing. And as a bodybuilder, I was a bodybuilding historian. I mean, I came up right along parallel with Mike Tyson's career. So for me, my bodybuilding journey was that of a fighter, an underdog. Mike Tyson at the time was short. He was young. Uh-huh. He had a short reach. He was very strong, but he had to battle some big guys in that ring. And for me, everyone was bigger than me. I hit the tail end of the era where the 5'6", 200-pound bodybuilder was becoming extinct with the comings of Lee Haney and Dorian, and of course Ronnie. I survived right. that era. But my mindset was that I had to just be the best Sean Ray I can be. I had to do more than what my training partner did, and I had to be willing to pass up on all the fun stuff the teenagers were doing. And by that, I mean it was a conscious decision in my mind that if I was going to a party, I wasn't going to a party to drink. I was going to eat. I needed to fuel my body. And it was a conscious decision that if I stayed out late, I had to sleep in just a little bit more to make up that sleep that I didn't get because I stayed out late. I made sure that I ate every 3 hours. I mean, literally, I had a little pinger on my phone, on my watch, uh-huh. that reminded me every 3 hours, 6, 9, 12, 3, 6, 9. I was like clockwork. And that discipline, that mindset took me places that I had only envisioned when I looked at the things that I thought were not attainable. And as I slowly chipped away at those small goals, I had to keep coming back to the mindset of doing the things that nobody else wanted to do. And by the time I was done, I went places that other people could only dream of going.
Right. I tell you, that's a really misunderstood aspect of success in all areas of life. When you go around the world, Sean, and you have these packed seminars, do you think they fully appreciate when you talk about your story and the discipline and the struggle? Or do you think that in their minds, they skip all over that and they say, well, you're Sean Ray, like it came easy yeah. for you. Do you think you're really connecting when you give them that message?
Well, I try to remind them, first of all, I'm no different than them. I'm the son of a janitor. I'm the eighth on the list. I'm the youngest in my family. Uh-huh. In high school, I came behind a long line of football players, but I was the only one that had their football jersey retired and put into the High School Hall of Fame and uh-huh. still hold records today, 30 years out of high school at the school I played football at. When I did something, I was all in. I mean, I could have ran my dad's janitorial business because I was cleaning toilets at the age of 5. And when you clean toilets for a living, because that's what your dad does, you don't think of it as being slave labor. You don't think of it as being beneath the white collar stuff. It was how we kept the roof over our head. It was how I was able to, get the things I wanted from my dad by helping my dad. So as I grew up, the grunt work of bodybuilding, of doing the deadlifts and doing the squats and doing the cleanup work with the hyperextensions and the abdominal work and the road work that people don't like necessarily doing, because back in those days you wanted to put the tank top on, uh-huh. show off the pec, shoulders and arms, and don't worry about the legs. But I mean, for me, I worked from the ground up. My legs were my strength. It's what got me into the Football Hall of Fame in high school. But being that when I talk to people, that I didn't come from privilege. They talk about genetics. Genetics are only really truly realized if you put in the work.
Exactly.
Listen, Shaquille O'Neal, he's shot as many free throws, if not more, as the next centers in the NBA, but he can't shoot a free throw to save his life. I mean, his shooting percentage right. is probably like 30%.
Right.
However, he retired as one of the league's leading scorers. So he compensated in other areas. And for me as a bodybuilder, knowing I'm 5'7", knowing that in high school at 1984, Lee Haney's winning his first Mr. Olympia, and I'm graduating high school, that one day I'm standing on stage with him. I caught the last three Olympias that he was participating in all the way up to his retirement party. And I was training to beat Lee Haney. I mean, in high school, I couldn't have never thought any level of a stretch of imagination that I would be one day training to stand next to and potentially have an opportunity to beat Lee Haney. And I came very close in 1990, standing there amongst the final three with Lee Haney and Lee Labrada and myself. And again, in the top five in 1991. But my reality in 1984, watching Lee Haney win his first Olympia, was never like that I would one day up there next to him. But to get to that point, 4 years later, 1988, 22 years old in Los Angeles, I knew I had to put in the work. And this is what I tell everybody. You can have all the genetics in the world, but if you don't put in the work, no drugs, no genetics, none of that's going to get you to the promised land. And I think it gets glossed over, the amount of volume
yeah.
and consistency that we have to dedicate ourselves to our craft to get to where we get to.
Yeah, that's what I want to bring out. I really want to examine, dissect your mindset through a series of questions. I want to bring that out. I totally believe exactly what you're saying is that it's just the connection is missed. They just see Sean Ray and they just see where you are. One thing that I want to add in is that, look, if you're going to be legendary, known for, I mean, Sean Ray has been going strong. Must be 30 years now, Sean.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
Look, yes, he has amazing genetics, right? But you don't become legendary, Hall of Fame, without a combination of hard work, intelligence, and genetics. You have to have all three. You know, you can just be a great hard worker. You can know all your science. You know, the genetics is why we're talking to this legend. And he is a legend, Sean Ray. That's a piece of it. When you're listening to it and breaking down, you want to model his success. Don't just skip over the genetics. If he didn't have the genetics, we wouldn't be talking to him right now. What you need to model, you know, your genetics, listening out there, your genetics will take you wherever. And whether that's intelligence because you want to make a $10 million or, you know, whatever your craft, you want to be a screenwriter, whatever it is. I mean, your intelligence, whatever genetically, you make the most out of it. But it comes down to that work ethic and this mindset that we're talking about. You know, Sean, I know you talk a lot. You held your late father in such high regards. You just kind of shared his work ethic and how he passed that along to you. Tell me about that relationship and tell me what your fondest memories are of your father and what he taught you that you carry on, that you carried on throughout your bodybuilding career, your great career afterwards, and what you're passing along to your children.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I mean, being the youngest has its privileges because I was the last one to leave the house. My parents divorced when I was 17. My brother, who's 1 year older, got married at 23. He'd gone away to college. So I was the last one to leave home. And when I did leave home, before I did, I was splitting time between my dad's house and my mom's house while I was in college. They both were supportive of what I was doing. They didn't understand it. And then when I started having a little measure of success, of course, then they really were all in. But with my dad, you know, I was living at home trying to build a bodybuilding career, but I had to be a full-time student. That was the condition. If they were going to feed me and give me gas money to do my, at that time, was a hobby, then I had to stay in school. So I was in junior college and in at Cal State Fullerton.
Why was that so important to your parents? I know that you have accomplished siblings too, but why was education so important to your parents?
Well, it was important from the standpoint that, look, the house I was born in, my dad had to fight the city in order to buy. He qualified for the loan, the first black man in the track, had to come up with a lawsuit against the city to actually purchase the property.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And then he wound up getting onto the city council. He became a city councilman as a result of that. And my dad, you know, he'd done 3 years in the Air Force and he was an electrical engineer. He traded it all in for a mop and bucket because he saw the opportunity and freedom to be able to work at nights and be home during the days. My dad never missed a football practice of mine.
Wow.
And, you know, I would go out and run for 150 yards skip on Friday night in high school. And 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm cleaning toilets and dumping trash cans in big warehouse buildings. And Saturday morning, I'm watching films with my teammates for, you know, of the game. Some people in the neighborhood knew that because a lot of kids worked for my dad. I kind of grew a little bit of resentment for it because I started to feel, you know, I just ran for 150 yards and 3 touchdowns. Why am I out here, you know, cleaning toilets? I should be, you know, held in high regard. I should be, you know, worshipped or whatnot.
Right.
Last thing I wanted
ticker
to
tape doing. Parade, right?
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to do was hear my dad come in, like after I'd gone out with my friends and I'm sleeping in bed. We got to go to San Diego to clean a building. But it was my life from 5 years old. And later in life, when my dad passed away in 2010, but he got dementia and he had congestive heart failure. He moved in with my sister. My sister's an attorney. She has an autistic son. She has another daughter that was in college in Atlanta, Georgia. So she had a lot on her plate. And I sold my house to move closer to help take care of my dad until the final end, which was 4 years later.
Wow.
I spent probably the most time with my dad out of all of my siblings because I moved only 5 miles from home. But I understood my dad. My dad came from the old school. My dad's mom's mother was a slave.
Wow.
She died at 92 years old. We're not that far removed from those times. I had some great stories from my dad's mother, but my dad had, he didn't have a privileged life.
Right.
And I went to places in the world that my dad could only dream of. He was my number one fan. And my bodybuilding career was dedicated to never having to go back and clean toilets again. And my dad made sure that if the bodybuilding thing didn't work out, the education was going to. So the only way I was able to bodybuild, I did the Mr. Olympia and turned 23 years old the day after the Olympia. I came home, and on Monday, I was sitting in a college classroom. No one even knew I was in the Mr. Olympia.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, I was 13th place. I think I got a check for $2,000 for participating, but no one even knew I was in the Mr. Olympia. And I'm thinking to myself, how do I've got to find a way to monetize this. I mean, there's got to be more, because I'm just, the college thing is not where my passion is. It's the bodybuilding. I made a conscious decision when I came back from that Mr. Olympia in 1988 that I was going to make it work. And literally, I found out the way to turn muscles into money. And I have never punched a clock for a company that I had to go and report to. I've made my living solely off of lifting weights. Every paycheck I've ever gotten, Skip, in my life, has been a result of my bodybuilding career.
Right,
I've never had a situation where I had to go to a job and do all that stuff. I turned what my passion was into my work, and I can honestly say I've never worked a day in my life. The only time I worked was when I was doing janitorial work for my dad.
Yeah.
And that's not work. That was a lifestyle. That's all I knew.
Well, but I tell you, you know, it's interesting that you talk about your father and the discrimination moving into your town. It's we want to think that we're so far removed, and you made that point. We're not so far removed from racism, and you had to live with that. We got a question from my Facebook page. Jamadi Kaul said, what was the thing that made you so committed in his road to make his dream a reality? I mean, did he have a painful childhood or something else?
Yeah, absolutely not. I had a glorious childhood from the standpoint that I was born in 1965, right smack dab in the middle of the civil rights movement. Malcolm X was shot that year. John F. Kennedy was killed in 63. Vietnam War was going down. The British, the Beatlemania was going on. There was a lot of stuff going on in 65. The Watts riots, 30 minutes from where I was born, was going down. My mom's brother was arrested in the Watts riots. There's a lot of stuff going on. And I was born in a predominantly white neighborhood. I was like the only black guy on the football team. I was like one of five black kids that weren't my brothers or sisters that were enrolled in the schools. And being a standout athlete, we kind of cut through the color barrier.
Yeah.
Until it came to dances, high school dances. You want to ask the girl. It's not like you had a bunch of people to choose from. They were either white or Mexican, because we lived not too far from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
You know, Mexico's a 2-hour drive down the highway. So it's mostly whites and Mexicans that we lived around. So here comes the Sadie Hawkins dance, or the homecoming dance, or the prom. And suddenly people are acting funny. You know, the girls like pick me up at the corner of my street. You know, you can't come up to the house. I'll come over to your house. There was no shortage of girls to date. However, the parents were not that receptive to me or my brothers showing up at their door. And the irony of that is, by the time I turned my body into the bodybuilding business, and you go back into the neighborhood, or you go to some of the old parties, or you have these reunions, the people become more forthcoming. I went to my high school reunion the 10-year, and I got second in the Mr. Olympia that year, 1994. My 10-year reunion from high school, I was second place. And all the girls could tell me was, oh, I used to be afraid of you in high school. And I was afraid. I said, well, what was going on with all the fear? Well, my parents didn't want us around the black guys. And my parents, they thought that you guys were kind of wild because you guys were driving cars. Well, we drove because we had to clean my dad's buildings that we worked at.
Yeah.
And most of those kids weren't driving cars. But, you know, there was a racial component that weren't amongst our peers, but it was still coming from the parents. And my major studies was social studies. I dealt with race relations. I was dealing with different cultures, traveling the world as a bodybuilder, but I never had any hardships. Both my parents worked. We had a live-in Mexican nanny that was there Monday through Friday because I'm the youngest of eight. There was five of us when I was growing up. And my parents would come home at different hours. They worked different shifts. My dad's a janitor. My mom was working for Rockwell as an engineer. And so we had to have this adult in the house, and it was, you know, rotated every couple of years with a different non-English-speaking nanny that was Mexican that cooked Mexican food. So we didn't struggle for anything. We didn't want for nothing. What made me want to be the best is I wanted to be the best football player. I played football to win the Heisman Trophy, to get a scholarship, to go to the NFL. When that dream faded, when I got hit in the knee my senior year, I went into rehab, my knee, and that's when I realized that I'm going to turn into a bodybuilder. When I came after bodybuilding, I went after it the same way I did as a football player, to be the best. When you're talking about the mindset, I'm going to go back 1 second. When I lifted weights, I was lifting to be Mr. Olympia. I wasn't lifting to win the California. I wasn't winning them in the Ironman or the Arnold. I was trying to be the very best bodybuilder in the world. And I envisioned myself training back. I was Robbie Robinson. Training arms, I was Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, doing legs, I was Tom Platz. I assumed the persona of those stars that had the body parts I wanted. So it wasn't just lifting weights. It was, you know, for me, it was trying to be the best.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, Sean, is that that's, you know, you were thinking big right from the beginning. You know, you see how some guys, they kind of just want to show up, and if they do well on their local show, then maybe they'll graduate. But normally they don't get too far because they don't start with that big picture in mind. So I think that's a great success strategy. But let me ask you this question, is that I've only known you as a supremely confident guy. And I tell you, I've been studying this stuff long before I became a bodybuilder. And, you know, coming into, you know, our culture, that type of supreme confidence isn't common. And I'm going to ask you that after we take a short break, is what makes you different? How did you start off with that confidence? What makes you different than the rest? And I want you to tell me, without, you can talk about names, you don't need to, but the mentality that's drawn into bodybuilding, and, you know, why you're so different in your mind. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Hall of Fame bodybuilder Sean Ray.
You're listening to Skip LaCour's Bodybuilding and Fitness Podcast. So, you have your bodybuilding and training efforts going in the right direction. That's awesome. Are you now ready to take your entire life to the next level too? Sure, it takes a lot of focus and discipline to build a great body, but that's not going to automatically translate into an incredible overall life too, unless you have a clear-cut vision for exactly what you want for your life and an effective plan that you really believe in to make it happen. Maybe you've already realized this. Your body has improved dramatically. People compliment you all the time, but you still feel that there's something missing. What's your plan to become more than just a great body and create an amazing, balanced, overall quality of life that you can be proud of and confidently work toward? One-on-one peak performance coaching specialist Skip LaCour will help you channel all that your hard work, discipline, and abilities to become more than just muscles and help you build a life filled with confidence, passion, and purpose. You can have it all. Confidence in every social situation, wealth, opportunity, freedom, love, and connection, along with your impressive physical body and amazing health, when you know the strategies to put it all together and execute them on a continual basis. Go to SkipLaCourCoaching.com and see the different one-on-one life coaching plans Skip LaCour has to help you. Set up a free coaching session to see if this exclusive next-level one-on-one coaching program is right for you by sending Skip an email at Skip@SkipLaCourCoaching.com.
We are back with bodybuilding legend, Mr. Olympia, top five finalist, 12 consecutive years, Sean Ray. So, Sean, before the break, like I said, I've just known you to just have supreme confidence. I mean, you must have had confidence back in high school. I want to know where that came from. You know, you brought that. I mean, you were so different than how you carried yourself than anybody else in the bodybuilding world. Now, it's kind of interesting to me, is that people are, you know, many years later with social media, they're trying to be you. You were you in that mold long before. And people kind of shunned you for sure, that supreme confidence, right? So where did that all come from? And then, you know, how you came into this culture, this bodybuilding culture, where people don't have that mentality. You set yourself apart. Tell me about all of that.
Well, I mean, I got to tell you, I was always aware of who I was when I put my football helmet on. I mean, when I played football again, Skip, like, that was my ticket. When I was playing Pop Warner football, I started at 8 to 18. I played football all the way through. I mean, I would know the head coaches of every NFL team, and I would know the salaries of all the players, and I would know the owners. I would know everything about what I was doing. And I brought that same mentality to the field so that as a tailback, I knew what the wide receivers' blocks were going to be. I knew how the guards were going to pull and the tackles were going to crack back and the tight ends were going to be dummies running fake patterns.
Total immersion.
Total immersion. So yeah. That followed me through into bodybuilding so that when I started, I'll give you a little tidbit of my mindset. When I went to the Nationals, it was a two-day event in Atlantic City, New Jersey. After prejudging, which was on Friday, Saturday was pretty much a wide open day. I think they might have been doing the women prejudging during that time, but I wasn't due on stage till Saturday night. I was coming off of winning the Mr. California only four months prior to the winning to go into the Nationals, but I was Mr. California. I went out and I printed up some 8x10 pictures. When I showed up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and I did my prejudging Friday night, Saturday afternoon, I was sitting at a table for ProTan, the tanning company, signing and autographing 8x10 pictures of myself in a show that I was competing in as Mr. California because I was Mr. California. Rory Liedlmeyer was Mr. California. My old training partner, Troy Zuccolato, was Mr. California. Mr. California back then meant something, and I knew that it had credibility. I made a couple of bucks that allowed me to, you know, do a few things while I was in Atlantic City. So I knew in the very beginning, I have to find a way to monetize my hard work and effort. And so I printed up the 8x10s. I sold the 8x10s. I went in the back of all the magazines, Muscle Mag, Flex.
Oh, wow.
I grabbed all the addresses of the supplement stores and all the gym change. I sent an autographed picture with all my contact information after I won the California to all of these people. By the time I was at the Nationals and I solidified it with a victory, when I came home, I already had people inquiring for me in 1988 to be a guest poser at their shows. So I figured if I can keep replicating that one or two weekends a month, then those one or two weekends a month at a couple $1,000s here, a couple thousand there, sooner or later, the nickels and dimes, they add up to dollars and cents. And I was with Joe Weider for 17 years, which it was inclusive of the publication and the supplements at the time. So I needed to find companies that were not publishing magazines or doing supplements. So I wound up hooking up with a clothing company. Then I got with a glove company. Then I got with a gym franchise. I was finding out as many ways to monetize my abilities from guest posing to speaking to autograph sessions. And I was Sean Ray Productions in 1987. I'm still Sean Ray Productions, 14 years in retirement, doing much the same thing without having to take my clothes off. But I'm still out there representing companies, making appearances, emceeing shows. There's a way to monetize your career. I got involved with producing videos and documentaries and made six DVDs along the way and put on muscle camps and created job opportunities for other bodybuilders because that's where the longevity is.
Right.
You can only compete for so long before you step off that stage. How do you stay relevant? You give other people opportunities.
Wow, that's a good idea.
You stay involved in the media. You stay involved in the game. Everything I have, I'm trying to give back onto other athletes. I passed it on to Richard Jones, shared it with Melvin Anthony, gave a lot of it to Flex Wheeler, still doing things with Kevin Livroni, and I'm still relevant because I'm passionate about what I do, and I still don't think it's work. You have to love what you do. And sometimes you do a lot of it for free, but somewhere down the road, you can find a way to monetize it. And I've managed to do that very successfully, but it all comes from doing more than what other guys don't want to do, including becoming computer savvy and understanding the social media, as well as the print media, as well as advertising and marketing and promoting. I have my own show, the Sean Ray Classic. You know, I've emceed the Mr. Olympia. I've emceed every contest around the country and around the world, over in Brazil and England and Germany and different languages. I'm dealing with translators. I love what I do, and so I stay relevant because I stay close to the action.
Yeah, I'll tell you, is that I'm loving this story because we get a glimpse with all the hustle. I mean, I just hear pure hustle there from day one. I don't think people in this industry, they realize that. They think if they have a great physique that the opportunities are going to come to them. And you see that all the time, Sean. And, you mentioned some of the people that you've worked with. They have not had your hustle. No matter how much, they haven't followed that same model, the Sean Ray model of hustle. Do you find that same thing when you're at seminars around the world? I mean, which is a great life strategy. I think that people just think they're going to be great at what they do, and then people are going to show up and hand them opportunities. I mean, you're telling us right now that was not the case with you. Yes, they did come to you, but it was with your prompting.
Right. Well, there's a lot. Potential's a very simple word, and we toss it around very loosely. But you got to remember, the people that come into our industry, a lot of guys come in here with low self-esteem.
Right.
They're fat, or they were skinny, or they have eating disorders, or they have drug issues. It's a very compulsive, obsessive type of a sport. But when you approach it and you put your passion first, everything else seems to follow. But knowing what's making it all work, understanding how to put on a show, knowing what the expediters are doing, knowing what how many judges are there, knowing what the athletes need backstage, knowing what the ticket prices are, knowing what time the shows are starting, what is the lighting guy doing? I mean, I know everything when I walk into a bodybuilding show. What's going on within the first 5 minutes and who's who. I mean, I like to know who's running stuff and then work my way down to the guy that's standing on the stage, escorting the athlete onto the stage, memorizing names and faces. And here I am 14 years later. My Rolodex is huge. Most of it's put to memory. It's easy now with Facebook and with Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff to reach out to people. But relationships for me have always served me well throughout my career. And like any other business, if you're a great football player, you can be traded. And if you're going to get traded, they're going to ask that coach or that team what type of personality this athlete I'm dealing with, that I might open my wallet and give him millions of dollars. Who am I inheriting? Am I inheriting a problem or an asset? And so the companies and the people that I work with, I always want to make sure that if we part ways, there's always something good to say, because you just never know when you're going to come back around there again to deal with these people, because life is long and opportunities are endless, and this is a sport that evolves. It's now become more inclusive of physique people. A lot of bodybuilders didn't like the physique guys that were coming in. The women bodybuilders didn't like the figure girls. The figure girls didn't like the fitness girls, and the fitness girls didn't like the bikini girls. But what you're finding now is you got fitness girls coming down to do figure because they no longer want to jump around. You have figure girls that it's just too hard to diet, so now they're going to translate and go into bikini. All of these things are, you have to be able to adjust and adapt. And I think above anything else in my career that served me well is I've been very adaptable. I've been very vocal. There's nothing I've said in this industry that I wouldn't say again right now and believe it just as I did then. Because most of the things I talked about that were controversial were things that other people couldn't say, they couldn't do. And I wasn't afraid of what would happen, because the truth for me has always set me free. And if I'm saying that the judges are not transparent with their scores because they're not putting their names to the scores, I'm not lying. If I'm saying that there needs to be partitions between the judges so that there's, you know, transparency, that's a fact. I mean, if it needs to move to the electrical age, which I've always been saying, the Olympia should be digital like the Olympic Games are in gymnastics. You get those scores instantaneous, and there's no BS, there's nothing like that. There's still a lot of change that needs to be taking place. I may not be as passionate from the competitive side because I'm not on the stage, but change, I think, is good. And I brought a lot of interesting points up that made me stand out amongst the crowd, because I was fearless, because my physique did the talking even louder than my voice. But it gave me a niche market to have the opportunity to be in front of the camera, because I always had something to say.
Being able to speak your mind, I can see where that comes from your father. He didn't just take it and move to whatever neighborhood he fought his way. I mean, you saw that as an example. He fought for his family. He fought for his rights. I mean, he didn't just stay quiet. I mean, that had to have been a great influence for you.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things my dad always said is, like, you can play the game, or you can be a game changer.
Mm.
And throughout my football career, I always carried the pigskin. Like, I got to be the difference. I have to change the game. I got to be the game changer by playing harder. And so I was naturally thrust into a leadership role, because my statistics, my status, I had to carry the team. And when I look back at those high school books and the pictures and the headlines and, you know, what I was doing as an undersized tailback, bodybuilding was a blessing in disguise, because this was not something that was made for a bodybuilder that was 5'7 and barely 210 pounds to go where I went. I mean, I competed in over three different decades, in the 80s, 90s, and in the new millennium. I competed against, you know, I lost, I should say, to two Mr. Olympia champions in the form of Dorian Yates and Lee Haney that shared 14 consecutive Olympia titles. I retired in the beginning stages of Ronnie Coleman's, I should halfway mark, of his four-year reign from 98 to 2001. He would go on to win a total of eight and retire after 2005 by getting beat by Jay Cutler. But I shared in a very highly competitive Hall of Fame bodybuilding career with guys that should have a Sandow trophy. I mean, arguably, Flex Wheeler should have one. Kevin Lavrone should have one. Richie Gaspari. There's a strong argument for Lee Labrada and even Vince Taylor and Nasser El-Sambadi. They don't, and I don't. That's history. I don't live in the past of what I should have had. What I think about is what bodybuilding has given me. And Arnold Schwarzenegger told me a long time ago, just what Joe Weider told him, is that you can make a life from bodybuilding, but bodybuilding can't be your life. Mm. And I've always had something to walk away from bodybuilding to. And when I retired bodybuilding, that's when I knew I would have to find something very important to fill that void. The same way when I left football. Football was my life, and bodybuilding consumed me, and so I wasn't lost. Yeah. When bodybuilding was done, I knew I wanted to have a family. Mm. I knew I wanted to have children. I knew I wanted to have a wife. I knew I wanted to build on something that would really be my legacy. And so I continued to bodybuild because that's what I did, but my life is my family, and that's what gets me out of bed. And I have to do the things that I do. I have to make sure that my passion doesn't burn out, because now it feeds my children.
Yeah.
It keeps a roof over my head.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you what separates you. You know, you're not shy with the words and shy with the confidence. You know, I know what I think, right? I want you've competed, you've traveled around the world with the greatest in your time period. The 90s were the greatest time period. You said, I had a comment on my Facebook page. The only thing wrong with you was you competed in the most competitive age of bodybuilding, right? Okay. So you know the personality types. This podcast is to bring out the success habits to so these people who are listening to my podcast, they can just apply this to any area of your life. So you've been around the best in bodybuilding. I want you to tell me what you believe separated you from the rest. And I want you to tell me when we come back who you admired in the sport and why. So we're going to talk about that when we get back later on. I want to get into the next phases of your life and your family and all the exciting things you got going on right now. So we are with Hall of Fame bodybuilder Sean Ray, and we're going to be right back.
You're listening to Skip LaCour's Bodybuilding and Fitness Podcast. Are you interested in one-on-one coaching with Skip LaCour, but you aren't quite sure it's a good fit for you? That's totally understandable, unless you've had one-on-one coaching in the past or have talked to someone in-depth who's had a great experience with coaching. It can be a real challenge to appreciate its full power and recognize the positive impact it will have on your life. You can get all of your questions about coaching answered by talking to Skip LaCour directly on the phone. Schedule a free 15-minute personal phone call and talk to Skip LaCour directly about your current situation, the goals you want to achieve, and the challenges you believe are standing in your way. Skip works exclusively with men who are the most committed to their success. He'll gladly take the time to explain all of the benefits of his one-on-one coaching programs and determine if the two of you would be a good match moving forward into such a close, consistent, and intense working relationship. Schedule your free 15-minute personal phone call and talk to Skip LaCour about one-on-one coaching right now by going to www.skiplacourcoaching.com/talk. Once again, that website address to schedule your free 15-minute personal phone call and talk to Skip LaCour about one-on-one coaching is www.skiplacourcoaching.com/talk.
We are back with bodybuilding legend Sean Ray. So Sean, tell me, you've been around. You have been just the model of success from a very young age. You took the bodybuilding world by storm from a very young age. And even afterwards, you're still a force. You have traveled around the world with the best, the high-profile names that everybody would know in bodybuilding. You talked about your experience with Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Joe Weider, and then your era of bodybuilders. I want to know what you think sets you apart from the rest.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Skip. That's a good question. And I think I've always been mindful of my surroundings. I always tried to align myself with people smarter than me. I always tried to align myself with people that kept their nose clean, were living a lifestyle that I could respect and admire, that had the characteristics and mannerisms that I wanted in reflected from myself. When you hang out with thugs, you become a gangster. You know, you hang out with party animals. It's a very small step to get sucked into that party animal lifestyle, and then you become that person. I was very careful to keep arm's distance from people that had one foot on the slippery slope on a banana peel and one foot in our industry. Craig Titus comes to mind. I worked with Craig. I trained with Craig, and I knew Craig, but Craig lived a different lifestyle. I made sure that I wasn't going home with Craig. I wasn't hanging out with Craig. I wasn't partying with Craig. And I tried to minister to him in ways where I could plant seeds. Lee Haney was a very good example of someone that when I thought about success, I thought about how he did it. I mean, he married his high school sweetheart. He had kids towards the tail end of his career and retired at 31 years old. It's unheard of. Most careers don't even get started
right
until you're 31. Lee Haney is still in high regard. I gave him the Lifetime Achievement Award for the Sean Ray Classic 2 years ago because that's the first person that I remembered wanting to be like. Now, Chris Dickerson was more along my ilk, but he was a 43-year-old Mr. Olympia. He was an opera singer. Chris was openly gay. And he was a father figure. He was older than me, but he was a person that I met at Gold's Gym. I wasn't intimidated, but in 1982, that's probably when I first looked at a weight. I didn't start bodybuilding until 83, but Chris Dickerson was the first black Mr. America back in like 65 and was the first black Olympia American because Sergio Oliva was black, but he was Cuban. And I met Chris Dickerson in 83 and it was a game changer for me. He was an opera singer. He was manufacturing posing trunks for the athletes at the time. He was running his Olympia productions. He was on the cover of Flex magazine, and he was my height. If not, he was a little bit smaller and a little bit lighter, and I thought, if he can do it, there's hope for me yet. I mean, I was inspired by actually meeting someone like that, and I surrounded myself with people that were more successful than me, and it gave me the tools to pay it forward to guys that were coming up behind me. Lee Labrada on the bodybuilding stage was a guy I prepared to beat. I knew his hair would be on point. I knew his tan would be immaculate. I knew he wasn't going to show up at the bodybuilding show wearing sweats. He elevated my game and my perception of how I was supposed to look, walk, and act. I mean, he looked like a Hollywood movie star. Bob Paris, the same thing. And then you look around some of the other bodybuilders, top guys wearing tank tops and boat neck shirts and shorts, and you know, they're banging loud music when they pull up to the gym.
Right.
Look at me type of a mentality. And I always thought, you know, these guys that are successful, they're not blowing. They don't have a blowhorn saying, look at me. Most of them are training covered up.
Yeah.
Most of them didn't want to even see what they look like in the gym. They don't want the attention because they're in the gym doing the work. The shirt comes on when the work comes off when the work is done. And throughout my career, I wore long sweats, long tights, and long sleeve shirts when I was in the gym. The only time you saw me in a tank top was when I was doing a photo shoot because I wanted to be like the artist. I wanted to be covered up until it was time for me to do the great unveiling. But my main thing that set me apart from a lot of these guys that had vices, number one, my dad always told me, wait till you're done with your bodybuilding because you love it. Don't let anything come between the love of what you do and how you do it. So I made sure I didn't fall in love. You know, I liked women. I couldn't fall in love with a girl, give her more attention than my bodybuilding, and then my bodybuilding suffered. I needed to love my bodybuilding career to make it a career. And when I was done, share that love when it's over. It wasn't going to last forever.
Was that a challenge for you?
It wasn't a challenge for me because I was global, man. I was on the top of my game. I mean, I was looking forward to getting out of bed and eating and going to the gym. I couldn't sit there and try to make someone emotionally stable and financially sound and share my life with someone and have my heart torn and broken and my physical, emotional needs invested in someone else's life. That was going to be my downfall. Lee Haney, that's all he knew. He needed that.
Right.
Lee Labrada, That's all he knew. He came up in the game like that. He won the Nationals in 85 and got married in 85.
Well, see, I see you as an anomaly in professional sports. You and Derek Jeter, all right, are the only ones who had this illustrious bachelor life, right, while you were on the top of your game. I mean, you know, you think about all the greats, you know, from Kobe Bryant, pretty much all of them. You know, and I have this theory that they get that connection in their personal life for that stability. But the real goal, you know, is to just be Hall of Fame, to be legendary. And I don't know, I just have this theory, because why would these top rappers, entertainers, why they're so young do they get married? Do you ever think about that?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, and I've said this a million times, the only thing I ever thought about in my bodybuilding career was Sean Ray. People will tell you that I was selfish. People will tell you that I was cocky, that whatever I was doing it for me. And I was, because I only had myself to look after. So I took care of my family, my mom, my sister, my brother. I have love for my friends, but I was bodybuilding for me. It was mine. No one even understood it when I was in high school. It took a while for my family to understand it. But for me, I looked forward to getting on that airplane and flying to Germany and being treated like a rock star in a gym. I looked forward to going to Australia and going out on stage and posing and showing my hard work and being rewarded with a big fat dinner and celebration afterwards and have people respect and admire me. That was for me.
And you never felt lonely along the way. You never thought that, hey, compromise path.
Yes. Let me get there. Back in the days of non-cell phones, my phone bills on the road were very expensive. I could have brought someone with me on my trip.
Right, right.
I was in Russia, and I was calling home. This is 1989. You know, cell phones were the big bricks back in the day. I think they were only in your car.
Right.
But, yeah, clearly the road can be very lonely. Remember, I cooked all my own food. I ate alone in my house, in my condo. I cooked and prepared my own food. I lived a very nomadic life. I had a place in Las Vegas and a place at the beach, and my home was in Chino Hills. But I was gone literally every other weekend. I was as busy as I needed to be because I had no roots. And I think not having any roots and looking for the best gym and in search of the best workout partner and trying to get, you know, when you lose, losing does something to you, because every time I lost, I would go back and take a whole nother year for me to get a shot at redemption. So I would train literally from January to September to try to win. I always believe I could win that Mr. Olympia if the stars were aligned right. And one year it almost happened in 94. My good friend Flex Wheeler got in a car accident, broke his neck, and was almost killed himself. He took himself out of the Mr. Olympia. He was second in 1993. But he was a good friend. He actually helped me motivate me for the 94 Olympia. 6 weeks out, Dorian Yates tears his bicep, the reigning Mr. Olympia. I mean, this is right for me.
Right.
Kevin Lavroni was he had torn his pec. And so here, all these things were lining up for me to come in and win this Mr. Olympia, and it almost came to fruition, and it didn't. It didn't devastate me, but the only time you have an opportunity to win is if you prepare yourself for that opportunity. So every year, I prepared myself to position myself to win. It was just one of those subjective sports where size did matter, and opinions weren't rotating enough in terms of the rotation of the judges and the opinion scoring. But I always thought, I'm doing this for me. I can be selfish. Bodybuilding is the most selfish sport. I don't want to inflict that on a female. I don't want to bring another personality. I don't want to bring a baby into the world that has to, you know, play second fiddle to me,
right,
to my meals and my gym. And I got to, you know, go train and stuff. When I travel now, my family's so cohesive and patient and self-sustaining. They understand daddy's got to go work so he can keep the lights on, you know, but I'm not, I don't wake up and run to the gym and my kids wake up and go, where's dad?
Right, you know, right,
I wake up, I have cereal with my kids, I walk my kids to school, and I'm a very present father, which makes it even more appreciative that I waited. So it's not for everyone. I waited. My kids never saw me bodybuild, but I don't need them to see me do what I do. I needed to be here to see what they're doing.
Right. No, I think you've made some great points. I think it's really next level thinking.
Yeah,
especially in our culture, and I'm all over social media, and it's kind of people preaching to the choir, people just like themselves. There's something that you talked about, bodybuilding being selfish. I think a lot of people in our industry kind of resist that and put that off. You know, they'll defend someone with three kids. What's your excuse? I mean, spending all this time looking fit. You know, I'm thinking about those kids, right? Because you know what it takes to look that way, right? And but it's, again, preaching to the choir. They're not seeing the other side of it. You were able to see that other side as you put your career together. Talk about that selfishness. What do you see that resistance to even wanting to believe that bodybuilding is quote-unquote selfish? Do you see that resistance in our industry?
Well, listen, if you're bodybuilding, doing physique, doing fitness,
bikini,
doing
that, whatever it may be,
it's selfish. And you're not going to be good unless you are selfish. It's how you quantify it. Now, look, right. It's not impossible. I just got done telling you, Lee Haney's still married to the same girl. Both of his kids graduated college. Josh and Olympia are grown. They're doing their own thing. And he did this at the tail end of his bodybuilding career, and he's still got a solid foundation. It's possible, but time management in bodybuilding is key to success. And most bodybuilders now—
Life management, right?
Life management.
Right,
well,
yeah.
What you're finding is a lot of bodybuilders are turning everything over to a trainer. Let me give you everything, and you tell me what I need to do when I go to the gym. And after I get done with the gym, you tell me what I need to eat. And then you tell me what contest is good for me. And then you tell me what color shorts I should wear. And then you have someone else telling you what you— – now, can you imagine Picasso, you know, someone sitting over his shoulder saying, use this brush, use this color, use this canvas? I mean, you're no longer an artist. And so for me, I'm pure. I'm raw, because when I went in the gym, I did what I wanted to do. I trained to look like the Sean Ray that I wanted Sean Ray to look like. I wore the clothes that I wanted to be represented. I chose the contests. I chose the food. I chose the supplements. It was all me. And I don't see that as much anymore. And it's because it's become a team. And teams aren't bad for certain people. It works well for some people. For me, I'm like my dad. I'm a very independent person. You couldn't tell me what to do. I just have to show you how to do it. And I've been able to share that with people. But as it relates to my family now, as looking back in retrospect, I still get to the gym, Skip, but here's how I do it. I go to the gym when my kids are asleep.
Right, right.
My kids get up at like 7 o'clock in the morning. If I'm going to the gym, I set my alarm for 5:30, brush my teeth, grab my coffee. I go to the gym, put in an hour. I'm back before they even know I was gone. And guess what? I have the rest of the day and night for my kids. But that bodybuilding aspect, the training aspect, they don't even know it. So it takes a discipline to quantify that and not take the time away from the family. Hey, kids, come on. You're going to sit in the daycare
right.
while I do my work. Instead, I selfishly get up while the house is still sleeping. My
right.
wife is here. And I go and do what I got to do for an hour, and I come home, and I haven't missed a beat.
Yeah, no, I definitely can relate to that. I do my best work at 3:30 in the morning while the wife and kids are asleep for a few hours.
Well, that's
for
the thing. That's the thing about our sport, Skip, is that a lot of people will tell you about the things that they can't do, but yet they want everything you have.
Yeah.
And you got to find time management. You got to have time, if you have a family, to make sure that they're solid and that foundation is good. You've got to have healthy alternatives, other interests. I was a movie buff. I'm an outdoorsman. I'm a historian. When I went places, I went to places I read about in college. I did book reports on Nelson Mandela. So when I was in South Africa, I'm right there. I went over to Robben wow. Island. I put my hands on the prison cell that he was in for 27 years. And I mean, I make sure that when I travel, it's more rich. The experience isn't just going to get a paycheck and just do the business. When I go to the gym, I make sure that, you know, being retired, that I enjoy the weights. Before it was work, you know, it was a war, it was battle. And now I enjoy and appreciate and respect the weights and how it makes me feel, more so than trying to beat someone. My whole life I was trying to train to beat someone, whether it was Flex, Kevin, Vince Taylor, Ronnie, Jay, all these guys that I had to beat. They were always on my mind, and now there's a different level of comfort when I train. I can actually appreciate it. And watching what Michael Jordan talks about playing basketball, it was such a compulsion for him to play at such a high level. You really do have to dial it down a little bit and retrain your mind that, hey, the contest is over. I don't have nothing to prove. So I do now just kind of train for general fitness and health and wellness, and I still kind of keep it away from the girls, because really, my girls aren't going to be bodybuilders.
Yeah.
I don't need to drag them to the gym.
Yeah.
if they want to go, I'll take them, you know, but they want to go to the park. They want to roller skate.
Yeah, I just think that you had a lot of life management. You did it in stages. You had the bigger picture in mind. How much of you having the big picture sounds like it was really planned? I mean, how would you weigh that a plan versus it fell into place?
Well, I think a plan – listen, that's why I said Sean Ray Productions was in place before I even won the Nationals because I felt at any given time my career could be snatched away. And so what am I going to do? I mean, the NFL guys, you wait till your career is over to get into broadcasting. You're playing catch up with the guys that were broadcasting in college.
Right.
So I always made sure to kind of have some type of structure.
And you created your own model. You know, you created you didn't have you talked about great champions. You talked about Lee Haney. You talked about Lee Labrada. Those are people for the people they are. I respect. I respected you for the way you handled yourself. But the model that you put together, nobody else did that. It's your own model. Do you see guys following that now, asking a lot of questions about it?
I can tell you, I've tried to share it with some athletes. We're at the stage now where you really can't even get to the athlete because they have their trainer or they have their guru or they have their manager. And you can't really get to know the bodybuilder anymore because they're hidden behind all of these people that are out front. You know, if you go try to talk to Jay Cutler, you're going to have to get through one or two pit bulls before you really get to Jay.
And you know, and the sad thing about that is now with social media, it should be just the opposite. Now you see people like CT Fletcher. Kai Greene does a good job, but they're so transparent and out there, they're really taking advantage of this social media. You do a great job on social media, sharing your life, sharing your opinions there.
Well, what I try to do is stay positive. I mean, listen, let's be honest. I was the first professional bodybuilder to fail the first ever drug-tested bodybuilding show right after Ben Johnson failed in the Olympic Games at the Arnold Classic in 1990. That could have ruined my career. It gave me perspective on how fragile a career really is when something that big happens in your life. I was able to right the ship and make the right decisions and promote myself and market myself without getting caught up in the depression side of winning and having it all snatched away, and I survived. And there are other athletes that didn't really survive. I mean, some like Mike Mincer never survived losing in the 1980 Mr. Olympia. Bertil Fox never survived the outcome of the 83 Mr. Olympia. Some people get changed forever as a result of a contest or as a result of a failure. For me, failure was always the wake-up call. Because life is fragile. And then you get to my age now and you go into funerals and you start rattling off the names of people you knew and trained alongside of that are dead. Ray McNeil, Art Atwood, Matt Duvall, you know, Nasser El-Sambadi, Don Youngblood. These are people I knew personally, Joe Weider, Ben Weider. You start to have a different perspective on life. And so for me, I respect the things that I had to do. And I try to share it with anybody that's willing to listen, that wants to be the next Sean Ray. At the right time. I mean, that's what's great about emails and Facebook. You get these messages and you can get very personal with a total stranger. And if you make a difference in one person's life, Skip, my body of work is worth it. And I constantly remind myself, I cannot take it with me. And I continually try to give back in various places around the world and through social media every opportunity that I can.
Yeah, and you do a great job of that. Here's a couple questions from social media. Tony Ruggiero asked, you'd like to hear if Sean has any regrets in life or bodybuilding. And then this kind of dovetails with a question from Sean Morrow. He says, did your pursuit to become successful in bodybuilding ever hold you back from having success in other areas of your life in which you regret now? Were there any thought patterns or beliefs that you adopted as a bodybuilder that served you well at the height of your bodybuilding career that you hold back now?
I think the blessing for me. Remember, I'm a 17-year-old football player standing on the sidelines of my last playoff game in crutches with a thigh high at my hip cast on my leg. My senior year, we lost that game. I stood on the sidelines in a game that I was like the pivotal player again, and we lost to Los Altos. And I was never going to put on a helmet again. I was never going to bite down on a mouthpiece. I was never going to put on a pair of cleats. I had an opportunity that summer, the following summer of 84, to play in an all-star game because I was still like all league and I was able to play in the all-star game. But it happened to fall 2 weeks after the teenage Mr. National Championships in Detroit, Michigan. Shane DeMora, Franco Santarello were in that show. I chose to do the Teenage Nationals because by then I was already bodybuilding. The one regret I have is that I didn't play that last football game because I could have. I was healthy.
Uh-huh.
But I was all in with bodybuilding, and I had to make a decision. Either I'm going to bodybuild or I'm going to get ready to play this all-star game. But if I play the all-star game, I might as well go to college and play football, right? Well, if I bodybuild and win this Teenage Mr. America, then I'm going to be a bodybuilder. I went to Detroit, Michigan. I got second place in my class. I lost to Franco Santarello that year as a middleweight. And I knew there was no going back to football because now I was going into college and I didn't have the resume coming off the All-Star game. I had to make it work. I didn't have a plan B. When I was in college, I didn't have a plan B with my bodybuilding because even if I got a degree in college, I still didn't know what I wanted to be. So I had to make bodybuilding work. So I have no regrets. Uh-huh. If anything, bodybuilding made me more well-rounded. It made me more worldly, more independent. It did make me grow up quite fast, but because it was an international sport and I was an international figure, I am grateful to the opportunity that I had with Joe Weider and his brother Ben to represent them for so many years because I saw the world. And, you know, most people work their whole life to save their life savings to one day dream about traveling the world. And then you get too old and too tired to actually do it.
Yeah. You know, Sean, there's a lot more to all this because there have been countless bodybuilders who have had the same opportunities of you that even didn't even come close to maximizing their opportunities like you have. There's something else. I think that, you know, your parents may have been divorced at 17, but you had that tight family unit, great role models. How much do you think that you started off on a higher level? You know, I know you're really into finance and Warren Buffett. You know, he said something. Someone asked him, what is the key to success, right? And you might think, well, he would say, start investing early or whatever, right? He said, the key to success is to have a father and mother who stay together and who love you unconditionally.
Well, unfortunately, in our industry, Skip,
yeah,
that probability is something that works against you. It's the same type of probability of you actually becoming a professional bodybuilder when you start out. Uh-huh. The odds are against you. So marriage, the divorce rate is like 55%. So getting married, while it's glamorous, it typically ends in divorce, and it typically just doesn't work out. I was fortunate that I had 17 years of my parents being together. But even still, the last few years weren't the most harmonious. I was just old enough that I could compartmentalize it.
Right. Well, they say when you get at that imprint age, like 7 or 8, everything mm-hmm. is done in that time period. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. But again, you can be – I just eulogized the guy that sold me a house a few years ago. He died in a bathtub, kind of like Whitney Houston did.
Yeah.
He had three kids, and I looked over at his kids, and I had to tell him. I said, you can be – just like your dad because he was your role model, or you can be like me and try to be better than your dad. My dad did the best he could.
Sure.
Loving my mom didn't have anything to do with how I turned out. My dad was a good father in spite of my mom, in spite of their differences. My mom was the best mother in spite of my dad, in spite of their differences. I didn't want to be a janitor. I wanted to be better than a janitor. And now I try to tell my kids, they got to be better than me.
Yeah.
They want to work out in the gym, great. But they've got to be better than me. So I raised the bar for myself by trying to do something that I can control. If you get control of your destiny and your future financially, then you can – the sky's the limit with what you can do. But you got to find your passion first.
Well, I feel like a lot of the people you travel around the world with, the bodybuilders, they're starting off in a mental and emotional hole that I don't think that you started off in. I mean, do you see, you know what I'm talking about?
That's you probably nailed it on the head because just conversationally, you can tell the guys that are sitting there talking about their Xbox and about their fantasy football – and you look over and you see the other guy sitting there, you know, reading the newspaper to find out what's going on in the world or talking about the place that they're actually going to visit because they did the homework before they ever got there. I mean, conversation can tell you a lot about a person. And I always said this, Skip, is that I was good as a bodybuilder or great as a bodybuilder, call it what you will. But that wasn't all I was. I looked forward to doing things outside of bodybuilding that kept me well-rounded. I had 3 newspapers delivered to my house. This is before we had the newspapers on our cell phones.
Right.
But I was global, so I needed to know what's going on in the world. I made sure that I was calling people when, you know, was it 3 o'clock in the morning their time? So I'm mindful of, you know, keeping my keeping in touch with people that are doing different things. One of my best friends sells cars for a living. The other guy's a doctor. You know, I got a wide variety of friends that kept me balanced and kept me whole. And I can tell you, I probably have four bodybuilding friends, and three of them, or I should say now, all of them are retired. Uh-huh. You know, all of them are out of the game. And, you know, three of them have their own businesses. And one of them, I got to say, his wife does pretty well. He's like hit the lottery. And you just don't know what life holds for you.
Sure.
But you've got to be diverse. Warren Buffett should have said is you have to stay diversified. You can save all your money and die of a heart attack tomorrow and somebody else is going to spend it. But if you have diversity and you live a rich, full life, there's time for the gym, there's time for the family, there's time for yourself, and there's time for, you know, for other things that you're trying to work on. But you have to have that. You cannot just eat, sleep, and train and expect one day that you're going to wake up and all the pieces are going to fall into place.
Well, I think what they do is they find that comfort in that pattern and structure, and it kind of fills their stomach, so to speak. I mean, their appetite mm-hmm. is curbed to do those other things because they find that solace that they look for. Anyway, those are some things that, you know, I've noticed being in this industry, some of the things maybe I've even gone through myself. I want to know, though, and this tails on what the second part of Sean's question is, any of the thought patterns, the beliefs that you had that made you a champion bodybuilder, did you have a hard time shaking them off afterwards and they were kind of taking away from the quality of your life once you left bodybuilding? Anything you can think of? Or once it was gone,
when I walked away from bodybuilding, it was like walking out of the military. Some guys come home, they have the PTSD because they keep playing the past over and over in their head. I embraced my past. I appreciated what I did. I was the David against the Goliaths, and I got out injury free. You know, I was blessed and fortunate. I look at my journey through the IFBB as one of survivalship. And yeah, it had its ups and its downs, and I didn't hang or cling to one or the other more than the other. You know, when I was up there on the top, I was riding high. And when things didn't go my way, I was riding down. But I would find my way, my solace in finding something else that interests me. And Donald Trump said it best, you have to have the art of the deal.
Yeah.
So while I was doing a get ready for the Mr. Olympia in 1998, and I figured, you know, might as well make a video about it. So I made the Final Countdown, you know, and I chronicled the process of dieting down all the way backstage. And Sergio Oliva was back there and Samir Banu was back there and got Larry Scott on camera. And I chronicled it so that people can see exactly what happens from 12 weeks to backstage, to the photo shoot, to the aftermath of competing. So 45 minute video. My final year of competition, I did Inside and Out Behind the Muscle. And that shows the layperson everything you need to know about being a bodybuilder. Like, how do you make your money? They pay you to lift weights? No. So I show you in this video the entire process of it. So I found things that made the journey interesting, and I can share it, and it can go viral. I mean, now you can pull it up on YouTube.
Right, right. You talked about one of your success strategies, right? And that was getting around the right people.
Right.
How aggressively did you go after those people, by the way?
Well, I can tell you, success brings people out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
The more successful you are, you don't have to go looking very far. You know, everybody wants to be around a winner. Everybody wants to be around a champion. So, you know, when you go to the Grammy Awards, there's artists that are sitting in the front row that probably never talk. But when you look at them, they look like they've known each other their whole lives because there's this mutual respect and admiration. So when you go to these shows, and I've never missed a Mr. Olympia since 1988, when the first time I was in it. And here we are, what, 2015? The Arnold Classic, this will be the 27th year next week. And I've never missed one since 1989. I put myself in places where the best of the best are. I'm available. So when I did my documentary on the evolution of bodybuilding and got a chance to talk to, you know, Larry Scott and Frank Zane and Lou Ferrigno, they were very candid with me, but these weren't friends of mine. These guys paved the way for me, but they had a mutual respect because I was successful.
Yeah.
They knew who I was. They followed the sport the same way I studied them before I ever arrived on the scene. They were watching me throughout while they were done.
Yeah.
And so when I knocked on Frank Zane's door to do an interview, it was like an old friend showing up.
Right.
We sat there and we talked like we knew each other for years. The same way we share the same mutual respect. I know exactly what you did in the world of bodybuilding. Why? Because I watched you.
That's what I was going to talk about, getting in the presence. I mean, I just remember like 1990, Ironman. I mean, I mean, that was such a great time in my life. It was 25 years ago, just falling in love with this bodybuilding and Sean Ray's posing routine to Luther Vandross. It was absolutely mesmerizing. You know what I mean?
Thank you. I was 24 years old. I had my whole family here in Redondo Beach. It was 30 minutes from where I grew up. So that was my first pro win. I remember it like it was yesterday. And so there's something to be said about the first time you ever do anything.
Yeah, but you're in my nervous system. And man, from that point, you know, I'm, because of your hustle, and I've always admired your business acumen and the way you carried yourself. I'm proud to say I was the first person I got in your company. I was a nobody bodybuilder at that time. Well, if I ever became one, but anyway.
No, you did. What you did was nothing short of amazing. Don't
but I built your first website. I said, Sean, I'll build your first website, right?
Yeah, so you did. Absolutely.
And I hustled to get in the company, you know, of winners. And I think that's one of the key strategies that Sean was talking about. You know, I want to take another quick break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about your family. I want to know this family, man, these family values, because it's such a dichotomy from what you did when you became a champion. Some advice that you may have for the fitness people who are trying to, you know, have their fitness and their relationships. And then I want to talk about all the exciting things that you're doing right now. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Sean Ray.
This bodybuilding and fitness podcast is brought to you by Skip LaCour's Mass Machine Nutrition, the highest quality and most effective bodybuilding supplements and sports nutrition products on the market. Supreme. Clean. Mass Machine Nutrition. Check out the entire line at www.massmachinenutrition.com. Skip LaCour's Mass Machine Nutrition is also available at the world's number one online supplement store, bodybuilding.com.
We are back with Hall of Fame bodybuilder, the legend, Sean Ray. So Sean Ray, we've talked about your career, that focus, that dedication. You were set apart in your thinking and professionalism, taking action, everything about you. Was just on point, from the tanning, the posing, the business, your speaking ability, how you present yourself as an ambassador of the sport, just, and you're bringing that with you right now. But before we talk about what you're doing now, you're still firmly implanted in the bodybuilding industry, making a living, a great living too. But let's talk about your family. You got married about 13 years ago or so. He started a family. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, I retired in 2001. I got engaged in 2002. I got married in 2003, and we had our first kid in 2005 and our second kid in 2008. And April 4th would be 12 years. That was kind of by design as well. I mean, I knew that if I'm going to get married, I'm going to be trying to have kids. I mean, otherwise, you know, what's the point? I mean,
right.
Family, to me, I'm the youngest of eight. Family was all I looked forward to as I was traveling around the world and my brothers and sisters were having kids. I knew that that was a big component of my life with all these nieces and nephews running around that I one day wanted to have. I mean, I had the cars, I had the houses, I'd been all over the world. I had some money in the bank. That was the one component that I had to be very selective when it came down to it, because it was going to take a certain individual that would have to embrace who I am and not who I was, but who I wanted to be. And
right.
So I met my wife. We joined a church. We got into Bible study groups, and we rooted our relationship and grounded it in our faith so that we had some accountability and some checks and balances. And that, you know, bodybuilding is so self-reliant. And we, you know, I've always had a faith. I never really had a strong faith, because bodybuilding makes you feel like everything you do is a result of your hard work by yourself, because
right.
you buy the food, you eat the food, you lift the weights, and you're healthy because of what you do. But there's something bigger at work. You know, I mean, I was blessed to be able to do what I was doing, and I needed to get in touch with my spirituality. And my wife was a driving part of that. And we got pregnant in 2004 and we miscarried. Uh-huh. And it tests your faith when you miscarry a child. You don't know how prevalent that is until you have one, because people don't talk about it. And then you do see how unfortunate it can be. One of my training partners' wives had three miscarriages before she went on to have three healthy boys. But We lost our first child at 12 weeks, and it was a crushing blow.
Yeah.
It was a test of our faith. It was a test of our relationship. You just think things fall into place because you're married and you're pregnant and life's going to take care of itself. But, you know, you hold your breath until that baby gets here. You pray it has 10 fingers and 10 toes and it's healthy.
And that's just the start of it, right?
And that's just the start because, you know, then you got to provide for this kid and you got to take care of your wife and you got to keep this together. And you're used to living this nomadic single life and there's a lot of adjustments and it changes who you are when you have these people that are relying on you, this baby that's, you know, one day going to be, you're going to walk down the aisle, hopefully, or, you know, put through school and through college. And, you know, I now realize how much my dad did love me and how much my mom did care for me because I have my own.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you just cannot explain to somebody that one day, my dad always said, wait till you have kids.
Uh-huh.
I never grasped it, you know?
Well, let's back up a little. Let's talk about Christy. You know, watching your reality TV show, Raising Asia, by the way, my wife wanted me to tell you how she's such a big fan. And my mom also, she was from Dance Moms because my mom's a big fan. My mom used to be one of those pageant producers way back in the day, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. she knew all about you before she even knew who I knew. She knew all about your daughter, right? But I remember
Asia's dad. That's who I am.
Yeah, right. And so, but you talked about your wife. You called her an alpha male. You have these certain dynamics. I want to know. You know, when you were traveling around the world, what kind of girls you dated and then how you made that distinction and that difference. Now, when I get married, it's a different type of woman. Why an alpha female? How did you know that was going to work out?
Well, I think you become kind of a relationship expert in terms of, you know, testing the waters. You know, I had the luxury of not having to be confined to the city I was growing up in and living in, because having global exposure, you have a lot of options, whether it's South American or whether it's Dutch or German or English or Irish or Puerto Rican. I mean, wherever
you're making
you go.
The men out there drool, Sean.
Well, like I'm just saying, I mean, it's a big world. And when you look at a map, multiply that by a billion.
Right.
It's just ridiculous when you get on these airplanes and you travel the time zones and you go into these backwards little cities and places that have a lot of culture and they're rolling out the red carpet and they're expecting your arrival. It's not that hard to make friends. And you know, you still have to be selective. You know, you go over to, you know, certain places and you wind up in Sweden. You're like, wow, they're all beautiful.
Right.
I can see where Mike Tyson wound up in trouble. And, you know, if you don't have a checks and balance and a moral compass, you can get in a lot of trouble. You know, it's amazing that some of these bodybuilders don't have babies all over the world. but that being said, because it is a very physical sport, I had my fair share of girlfriends here and there. I had my exploration period, but my training partner, John Brown, who was my mentor, my dad, he said, listen, the only thing that's going to mess up your bodybuilding career is if you fall in love with something more important than bodybuilding. So I had a very strong presence of not to fall in love. So I had to keep my relationships very surfacey. I had friendships, I had acquaintances, and I didn't abuse that. I didn't take advantage of it. But I was never really in one place long enough to establish a real relationship, and I didn't want to be.
Uh-huh. You
know, I was traveling the world to work, to build a life. I wasn't trying to find a life. I wasn't in search for love. I wasn't the bachelor. So I loved life, and I loved women, and I loved my job. But at some point in time, like a lot of people, and I'm sure it's a lot harder if you're an actor or if you're an athlete in basketball, baseball, you multiply that by the publicity that you get, and it becomes a very selective process when you choose the one. And I needed to choose someone that knew what I did. And my wife used to compete. She did a couple Fitness Americas and Universes, and she's dieted and she's sacrificed. But at the time we started dating, she was in title and escrow working in the real estate industry. And she was living at home with her father. And I'd seen her throughout the years from like 1993, I think was the first time I saw her, but we never, our paths just kind of crossed surfacey. Well, when I stopped bodybuilding, I opened my eyes and started looking around my surroundings. Did I want to find a girl to marry that lived in Brazil? Did I want to marry a girl that was over in Canada or a girl that was, you know, someone out of the country? I needed someone that was rooted here so that if, you know, like I said, the divorce rate's high. I don't want to crisscross the country if it doesn't work out to see my kid.
Right.
So this girl was living at home, respectful, had a six-figure job that she didn't have a boyfriend at the time and wasn't looking for anything. So I was the pursuer at that point. And yes, she knew who I was and was skeptical because, like most big time bodybuilders, she knew that I, you know, I wasn't rooted in any one girl, but I let her get to know who I was by sharing and showing my world. I took her on the road. I showed her how, what I do. I showed her how the machine works. I showed her my passion. She saw the appreciation and respect that my career had built for me. And she came into my life and we lived together for a year. We got married and, you know, we built a life. And now it's one of those things where her genetics coupled with my genetics, we've created these genetic monsters. Yeah, and my daughter, yeah, she's a dancing beast and now she's singing. My six-year-old, she's a gymnast and she's doing flips and cartwheels and all kind of stuff. There is something to be said for those type of athletic genetics. But what we both agree on, because we come from an athletic background, is that we're going to let them drive us to where they want to go. My daughter wound up on national television because we stuck a video of her up on YouTube of her dancing and also her performing at one of my shows. And it got a lot of views. And then Dance Moms called. My wife accepted the call. She went out there with my daughter. They got on the show. Realized that Dance Moms really wasn't what they wanted to do. They didn't need that type of training. My daughter was a five-year-old national champion for eight-year-old and under. In the 25-year history of Star Power, my daughter was the youngest at five to win against six, seven, and eight-year-olds. And so the second year she went back, she was first runner-up as a six-year-old. It was a different style of dance, but she became first runner-up national champion. And then they did the Abby's Ultimate Dance Competition. So she went from Dance Moms to the Ultimate Dance Competition, competed against 13-year-olds, and she was a top three finalist. And it was from there that they thought, you know, this girl's just got so much talent. We need to find out what the family life is. And they created her own show, yeah, Raising Asia. They brought the cameras in and showed an extended version of kind of what all it entails raising Asia. But the problem I had as a father was they told us it was going to be a docuseries and they were going to follow her to her events and the things that she was doing. And then it started becoming kind of a dictation because my daughter was singing and they wanted her to dance because she was Dance Moms and Abby's Dance Competition and she was a national dance champion. But at the time they started filming, my daughter was singing. And they didn't write the music. They couldn't create and drive the music, so they had no rights to the music. And that changed the element of the docuseries, and it didn't make my wife very happy. So literally every day when they knocked on the door in hair and makeup at 6 o'clock in the morning, they were here for 14 weeks. My wife was sideways because she didn't want to be a part of the process because they were trying to dictate what was being seen. They were trying to drive the show, and we were trying to keep Asia sheltered as much as we could. But, you know, when you wake up with a mad wife that's mad at the production crew, it's going to come across in, hey, honey, can you pass the ketchup?
Right, right.
Ketchup. Well, you get your own ketchup. So when we watched it back, we didn't even have a chance to watch it. When we watched it, when the world saw it, we saw it in real time. They didn't even share the pre-production with us, which pretty much sealed the deal that my wife didn't want to go back for a season two.
But I see.
My daughter wound up getting her singing out there. She got her dancing out there. We got her on television. We got the 14 weeks on, you know, episodes. But they tried to make the show more like Dance Mom, where the parents are fighting, and the kids were like an afterthought. And this is Raising Asia. It should be all about Asia. So my wife kind of went sideways a little bit. I enjoyed the process because I loved watching my wife kind of squirm a little bit. She's a tough chick. But she reminded me that that's why I chose her. I needed a tough woman, and she wasn't going to let production walk all over her. And I see a lot of Christy's toughness in both of my girls. My little one is the shyer one, but Asia, she's a beast. She's got a movie coming out that's coming out here. I think it's in May. It's coming out, that she had a part in. But she's working on the national anthem now. She did a Christmas song, a YouTube video called Christmas Time. She's got over 500,000 Instagram followers and 280,000 people on 9 years old. I'm just as proud as her as any father would be of their kid. But the good thing is I can't take credit for my daughter's success. I'm just like dad. She's going for the game. I'm supporting my daughter in her Hollywood thing. And I'm there as an on-hand gymnastics parent for my six-year-old, because all I can do is bring her to the facility and turn her loose to the coaches. So I have this aspect of not having to make it all about me.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I really love the dynamics of your family. I didn't notice all that tension. I thought it was a really entertaining show. And actually, man, that song Rewind My Jam is stuck in my head. And it reminds me of summertime. You know what I mean? So it was, right. I thought it was a great.
Yeah, it was a very, you know, that experience brought us all together because we had my mother-in-law, my sister-in-law. I mean, we spent some quality time putting that together, and it gave us a very good introspective look at how we're going to pursue Asia's career, which I think a lot of other families don't realize. You know, the production crew was 30 people strong. They ate up three different garages in our homes and our neighbors. And, it was every day. It was a daily grind. And what you saw on TV was only half of what they filmed. So it was a trying period, but it was immortalized. And, you know, she's only going to be 6 years old on television one time. And we will have that to look back forever. But more importantly, we're looking forward to what becomes of both of these little girls. I never knew that there was going to be so much estrogen in my life as an older person. I'm going to be 50 years old, Skip, in September. So,
yeah,
I mean, you get what you need, not necessarily what you want. Right. I thought I'd be in the gym with the boys throwing the football around.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting, you know, being a parent myself, it's like, you know, all the opportunities that your children have, it's just amazing. You know, it made me really think, you know, how am I going to raise, you know, my kids? And I'm wondering, it's like you said, you sit back and let them do their thing. So it's really not so much about you pushing them as this, that you built this life of freedom. You chose well as a wife. And so these children have these opportunity to exploit and maximize what they want without distraction. Wouldn't you say, is that the key here?
Absolutely. I mean, stand aside and follow. You know, I don't necessarily need to lead my daughter to a gymnastics mat or to a recording studio or to a life that I want for her.
Right.
My dad, you know, would drive me to the football field, but I had to play the game. I had to find the passion. So I don't, I'm not one of those dads that's going to try to lead my kids to do something. I want to follow their lead and then support them the way my dad did. I think that's why I turned out the way that I did. And I enjoy the person that I am, and I think my dad helped make me the father that I am. I mean, that's, and you always want to be better than your father. My dad worked too much, as far as I was concerned. Bodybuilding's afforded me the lifestyle to be here when my kid gets out of school, to walk my kid to school, to, you know, do things with my kids.
Oh, yeah.
That my dad couldn't do on a weekly basis because he worked, you know, a lot.
Yeah, and Sean will share his life. Follow him on his Facebook page. He, you know, you see him with the pool and different hotels that this lifestyle has created him and his kids, having fun, enjoying life. He works very hard. He travels. You can follow him on facebook.com/sugarseanray. facebook.com/sugarseanray. That's your personal page where he shares his life and his family and his kids. It's really fun. And then he has his fan page at facebook.com/Mr. Olympia. Sean Ray. So, wow, that's really exciting. I really enjoy that, you know, being a father myself and watching you and seeing how you left it all on the table. You got everything. You milked it for everything it's worth, your bodybuilding career. And then you can move to this period of your life. It's very, very inspiring. I don't know of too many people who could plan out a life the way that you have. It's just
been... Well, I mean, one of the things that I'm able to sustain the lifestyle is because I work with one of the best supplement companies in Shreds as their international spokesperson.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I'm working, you know, side by side with Steve Bleckman, who's got the number one bodybuilding magazine on the planet in
muscular
development. So, I mean, I've constantly tried to align myself with the best. I work with Will Davish at Powerhouse Gyms Internationals. And of course, you know, through social media, I'm able to have other things that I'm able to do, like emceeing some of the top shows and some of the top amateur shows. Gives me entrenched athletes that are trying to go places that I've been and having a relationship with Arnold Williams, 27th anniversary of the amateur Arnold, where there's upwards of 860 amateur athletes.
Right.
And then I'll go to Australia. I'll go to Australia and I'll be working with Tony Doherty for the first ever Arnold Australia Championships where I'll be emceeing the amateur side. So I'm still in the sport
It
still tickles me that I'm able to get paid for doing the things that I love.
Well, those are, you know, I'm wondering, so Sean, you can go to musculardevelopment.com. Sean is a radio host there. It's also a podcast. He's a podcaster, analyst, writer, media relations, I guess is your official title.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
At Muscular Development. You do video interviews. You do radio interviews with the top personalities. Tell me about that. Again, your business acumen has made you attractive to Shreds. You know, they've had such a great pick in you to represent them long after you've retired from bodybuilding. And also you work with a business, another businessman who I really respect in this industry, someone who, you know, really gives back, and that's Steve Blackman, right?
Yeah, well, working with Shreds and Arvin Lal and Anker and, you know, Sean Dua over there, they've given me – their social media following is probably number one in the supplement industry.
Right.
And they've given me an opportunity to reach a new generation of athletes coming up that have a respect for what I've done and keep me relevant in terms of dealing with those guys and helping them out and being a figurehead for them as to – helping them, you know, making the right supplemental choices. You can order the supplements at www.sugarshawnray.com. That takes you straight to the Shred site. Steve Blackman, on the other hand, he knows it's all about relationships. Like, he wants an interview with an athlete, he just calls me and tells me to get the interview because I have the athlete's phone numbers. I have a relationship with them. And he doesn't have to tell me what to do on the ground when I have the microphone. I know pretty much what the fans want to know from these athletes because I've walked in their shoes. Those athletes typically know who I am because I've been where they're trying to go. So working with the multimedia company like Muscular Development and the team that he's also built to cover it, it tickles me in this day and age that you can be sitting in Africa and get real-time coverage of next weekend's Arnold Classic while I'm typing it onto the computer, onto the forms at MuscularDevelopment.com. And you could be anywhere in the world and catch it in real time. Sometimes you can't visually see it because the webcasts are a lot harder to do, but you can interact. You can try. I could say something about, you know, Dexter Jackson on stage, and you could come right in behind that thread and say, "Hey, Sean, you think Dexter's going to win?" And you'll get a real time response.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, it's just amazing.
Steve Blackman's, yeah, he's taken it to the next level.
Yeah, and he is a very good businessman in a industry where most people aren't business minded, and you know, a lot of people they voice. Because, you know, you aligning yourself with him and you meeting, that just tells you his standards are so high, and that relationship that you have, it's very unique. Who has stuck around to meet his standards as long as you?
Well, absolutely. And what I think is what's to be very important is that I worked very closely with Joe Weider, and I wasn't just a bodybuilder getting a supplement publication contract. I had a monthly column. I was the most photographed bodybuilder on Flex magazine in the history, more than Arnold Schwarzenegger up until the time I retired. So Joe had a very strong role for me over there at Weider Publications, and with the, you know, coming of the website and the digital component and the MD TV, Muscular Development TV and Muscular Development Radio, Steve saw a void that was there that I could step right into without having to be coached to do it. And I brought a certain decorum. I kept thinking about Lee Labrada. When that camera hit me, I made sure that I'm in a suit and tie.
Right.
Or I'm in a dress shirt. I didn't want to look like the guy that just walked out of the gym that used to be a bodybuilder that's trying to hang on to what I used to look like. And that mass with class moniker that Lee Labrada instilled in me as an athlete, I carry to this day as a representative of Muscular Development and the Hall of Fame class of bodybuilding.
You know what? I remember your very first interview on video, and if you remember, I emailed you. I said, "Man, this is your thing. This is your thing." I'm sounding like a Sean Ray stalker the more and more I think about it. You know what I mean? But that's how much of an influence you had on me.
Well, I got to tell you, I used to watch, you know, boxing used to be really big in the 80s when we were young, right?
Right.
And, you know, the boxer goes out there and does all these things, and you're just in awe, and the reporter puts the microphone in his face. And you start to kind of cringe. You're like, you know, turn off the microphone, you know, because the boxer only groomed himself to box. But, you know, you only fight the one or two times a year. But people want to hear about you. They want to know about you. So I took voice and diction. I mean, I didn't have a speech impediment, but I knew I needed to enunciate.
Wow.
I knew I needed to learn how to string my words together. I made sure that, you know, I read the dictionary, so there's a certain selection of words. I watched, you know, out of all my examples, Lynn Swan and O.J. Simpson and Howard Cosell on Monday Night Football, and I applied those principles of when they were standing there with the microphone in their hand to my interview skills today. I didn't just stumble into being this media person.
Wow.
It was something that was well-rehearsed and something that I worked on when people weren't watching. When I was in college, I took acting
for the camera, acting for the camera in a classroom with 23 students, and they gave us a script every other day that we had to act in front of a camera, and then one day we acted out, the next day we watched on film. That prepared me for those days when I walked out on stage and there was 1,000, 2,000 people sitting down waiting for me in one microphone like a stand-up comic to entertain them for an hour or two on conversation. I mean, public speaking is one of the most scariest things that most people are afraid of. Uh-huh. Speaking at a funeral is even higher up the list because there's emotion involved. I made sure that before I got to a microphone that I was well rehearsed, learning certain words, learning how to string sentences together, learning how to enunciate, and then also being able to have the eye contact and communication. I mean, clearly motivational speaking is a very popular thing today, but I was doing this back in 1987 when I was like 20, 21 years old.
Yeah, that's amazing. I thought I knew everything about you, and you know, through this time that you shared your life, I mean, it really goes to show you that success is a planned event. Nobody just shows up, no matter how much potential they have or how many gifts and talents or genetics they have. That doesn't make you legendary, and I think that you really prove this. I have one question for you, though. With all this talent that you've amassed and all these opportunities, I know how passionate you are about bodybuilding. Did you ever think about taking this show outside of bodybuilding during your life?
I didn't, because I had every opportunity my daughter has as far as Hollywood. I used to live in Marina Del Rey.
Uh-huh.
I knew a lot of people that were working in Hollywood, singers and actors. And, you know, some people don't know, but I was on the Dating Game back in the day. In 1989, I was on the Dating Game.
Uh-huh.
I was on the Phil Donahue show. I was on the Good Morning America show. I did a couple of auditions. But what I realized that I didn't want to be the jack of all trades. I needed to be Mr. Olympia. And I thought if I could do that, everything else would come. Well, having that narrow focus on being the best bodybuilder I could be created all the other opportunities that followed. It created the opportunity for me to get on television and have the Flex Magazine workout on ESPN in the 90s for 5 years running.
Yeah.
It created the opportunity for me to host shows around the world. It created the opportunity for me to have my own personal column and create these videos and do these documentaries because I was one of the best. I didn't necessarily have to be the best, but my goal in my mind was always to be the best. So I never really, Skip, wanted to be anything more than just the very best at what I do. And the only way I could do that was with a very narrow focus, but I still had to, when I wasn't in the gym, be well-rounded and versed. That's why I stayed in college. That's why I was reading 3 newspapers. That's why my friends weren't only bodybuilders. I had diversity. And that's why I lived in 3 different places while I was a pro. I lived at the beach. I lived in Chino Hills. I lived in Las Vegas. I made sure that I was worldly, and I think it served me well.
Oh, most definitely, Sean. What's next? What's next? How are you going to top all this? What's the next level for you?
I've already laid out my calendar for 2015. I'm sure there's things that will pop up here and there. I'm clearly waiting for my daughter to be out there on a pro baseball diamond or out in basketball singing the national anthem. She's working hard at doing that, so I'm looking forward to that. But more importantly for myself is just to continue to be able to give back. Again, you only gain true satisfaction when you make a difference in someone else's life, because I've already been blessed. If I died tomorrow, Skip, I'm sure some people would cry because I wouldn't be here the next day. But don't cry for my life. I've had a very good, full, rich life, one that I could never have imagined would have been as fulfilling as it is in this moment. Everything else from here is gravy. Again, I'll be 50 in September. And I've always thought that when I'm 50, I need to be where I want to be. But guess what? There's another level.
Yes.
There's another place I want to be when I'm 60. And when I'm 60, my youngest will be 16, my oldest will be 19. It's another phase of life for me in the next 10 years. So I can't slow down, and I won't slow down. So I plan on being very relevant in the fabric of this industry, because Rafael Santoja, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jim Lormer, God bless their hearts, Jim Mannion, these guys 10 years from now, I don't believe are going to be doing what they do at the level they do it. So I'm building my stamina in the next 10 years to be one of the guys that's pulling those strings and guiding the ship.
Yeah, that's awesome. Man, you're so inspiring. thank you so much for spending this time. I'm going to be looking forward to following your journey. Again, you can go to facebook.com/SugarSeanRay. Follow him on Facebook. I'm sure you probably have too many friends on that page. You can go to his fan page at facebook.com/MrOlympiaSeanRay. And when you go to Sugar Sean Ray, it'll take you right to Shreds. Connect with him there. You're on Twitter, Sugar Sean Ray. I'm sure you have Instagram. Yep. What's that, Sean?
Same thing. I mean, I don't do Instagram much, but Sugar Sean Ray.
Okay.
Everything Sugar Sean Ray.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to following what's next in this amazing life of Sean Ray.
Let me give you a shout out, man. What you're doing is great. I love the platform that you're creating and sharing these stories with these people that are out there in the industry. Congratulations to you and your wife and your kids. It's awesome. I love watching what you're doing as well. So we're blessed to have you as well doing what you do.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. For Sean Ray, I am Skip LaCour. Thanks for listening to this Bodybuilding and Fitness podcast. Train hard and think big.
You're listening to Skip LaCour's Bodybuilding and Fitness podcast. Do you feel that you just can't get yourself motivated and disciplined enough to actually do the important things you know you must to reach those goals in life that you always say you want? Have you ever worked long and hard toward your ambitious goals, only to ask yourself, is this all there is once you've achieved them? If you can relate to these challenges, feelings, and emotions, then Skip LaCour's book, It's a Matter of Trust, Confessions of a Recovering Bodybuilder, will give you the insight and perspective to finally understand the obstacles that stand in your way and prevent you from living the life you really want. It's a Matter of Trust, Confessions of a Recovering Bodybuilder is Skip LaCour's very personal and revealing story about his journey to find the oftentimes elusive feeling of happiness in life that we're all looking for. In this book, the 6-time national champion, drug-free bodybuilder, entrepreneur, and speaker shares with you the most powerful lessons that he's learned about life to make your experience the very best it can be. It's his sincere effort to make good on the promise he made to himself during his darkest days, to make sure that the personal pain that he suffered doing everything he believed was right, and most importantly, exactly what he did to overcome that pain, empowers you with more direction, perspective, insight, love, and passion sooner rather than later. In the social media age, where it seems as though everyone is trying to present their lives to be a lot better than they really are, Skip LaCour makes sure he doesn't play that game, so he provides you with the clarity and direction you've been searching for. Everything that happens in your life can and will serve you in some way, shape, or form. It's just a matter of time until you realize it. It's a Matter of Trust, Confessions of a Recovering Bodybuilder by Skip LaCour will help you realize this about your own life. This book could very well be the source of the inspiration and information that you need to finally take control over your life and find your personal path to happiness. To learn more about It's a Matter of Trust, Confessions of a Recovering Bodybuilder by Skip LaCour, go to www.itsamatteroftrust.com.